You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week on episode 227, Donald Trump has an enormous lead over the other Republican candidates. Is he the American Boris? Oh. England are currently playing Pakistan in a cricket test match that no one is watching. Why are they bothering? The loss of music venues across the UK has reached crisis point, according to the owner of London's 100 Club. But is it already too late to stop the closures? That's all coming up after Felt and Sunlight Bathe the Golden Glow.
Welcome to podcast episode 227. I'm Terence Stackham, and in the style of Jack Monroe, I will say they is Juliet Harris.
Oh, hello. Yes, I very much am.
What was that opening track, Jules?
That was Sunlight Bathed the Golden Glow by Felt. A cult hero that is Lawrence from Felt, who, bless him, has spent years and years and years trying to be the biggest pop star in the world, and it never seems to quite come off. But I think that's absolutely lovely. I really like that.
Yeah, he's a huge name on the indie scene, but without ever breaking through.
He's tried all sorts of things. He's tried denim. The denim stuff was really good in the early 90s. They were one of the original. The five bands on the front page, that famous sort of proto Britpop cover on Select, where that was sort of the cover that launched Britpop, quote unquote, with five bands on it. Funnily enough, some of whom weren't really, I wouldn't class Saint Etienne as Britpop. Yeah, they were on that. No. But Denim were one of the five bands on that, and that was pretty much their sort of peak, I think, really. But he's also been Go-Kart Mozart, I think, as well, which is also really good. But yeah, he's a little bit like the Norman Cook of the indie world, really, in that he's always, you know, doing something else and having another alias, except I don't know. I do like Lawrence, but it gets to the point where you do think, well, this music, I don't know. Is it enough just to make beautiful music? Maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, Jules, we still have a year to go before the United States presidential election.
We've got a year of this, Terence, a whole year of this constant. This is almost like the Scotland referendum again. This is all we're going to hear about forever.
Away.
Yeah.
It just won't go away. As always, the contest seems to start in earnest a good 2 years ahead of the election. For the Democrats, it looks like it should be Hillary Clinton, but the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is doing well in the Democratic debates. And his profile has been enhanced. He was impersonated by Larry David on Saturday Night Live.
Yes, he was. I thought he was very good, actually.
Very, very good. But George, let's concentrate on the Republican contenders, because it seems that no matter what he says or does, and sometimes he says and does particularly stupid things, Donald Trump seems unstoppable as the Republican candidate. The latest polls give him a 10-point lead over, I have to say, the intriguing figure of Dr. Ben Carson, his nearest contender. Ben Carson, he looks and indeed speaks like a character from Grey's Anatomy. It's most but Trump, though, seems almost untouchable. Julia, he's the American version of Boris Johnson.
Well, there is that hair, isn't there? The hair for me is the big strand that connects the two. But yeah, it's very peculiar, isn't it? I don't know if it's our view over, if it's just because we're over the pond, so we're separate from it. But you know, to the neutral eye, you do think, for gosh sake, you know, this chap is clearly, I can't understand how it's got this far. How can, you know, that's my kind of view on it, really. He just someone in a minute is going to go, surprise, you're on candid camera. I don't understand how it's reached the stage that it has when he just does. I mean, okay, you say that I'm speechless by Donald, made speech by Donald Trump. You say over here, oh, Boris Johnson, oh, he's a clown as well. But there is clearly, I hate to say it because I'm not a huge fan, but there is clearly substance to Boris Johnson. There is clearly a brain working very, very, I think Boris Johnson is actually a very shrewd and calculating man, and part of his kind of comic public image very much ties into that. And actually, there are some similarities with David Beckham, I think, who I think was more than happy to go along with the general public's issue of image of him being seen as stupid, when actually I think he's made a heck of a lot of money and had a heck of a lot of success by, you know, being very shrewd and you know, letting himself be underestimated. One of my favourite scenes in Four Weddings and a Funeral, I knew it was something long and unwieldy, in Four Weddings and a Funeral, James Fleet's character in it, they're trying to distract people away from a wedding, or they're trying to persuade people to go another way to buy Hugh Grant more time, and James Fleet walks up and says, oh, I've sent them off in the wrong direction. He said, that's the advantage of having a reputation as being thought of as slightly stupid, people are less suspecting of you. And I do think that as far as Donald Trump is concerned, maybe that's going on. I don't know. But I do find it to be very peculiar. And I have to say, it is slightly depressing, even by Republican standards, that to me, Carson is a far more compelling figure. And I think would if the Democrats do go with Hillary, which I think they probably will. And I saw some of the debate the other week, the first major Democrat debate. And actually, I thought that Clinton won it easily. And I have a lot of sympathy for the views of Bernie Sanders, but I thought that Clinton by far and away looked the most comfortable and the grown up. And she just looked like a president in waiting in the way that nobody else did. I think if the Republicans, it's almost there are parallels with what's going on in politics over here and who you pick as your leader. I think if the Republicans picked Carson, I think he could potentially cause Clinton a lot more trouble, because I think that he would be more likely to win swing voters, whereas Trump really is, you know, I hate to say this, but you know, he's got your gun nuts sewn up, hasn't he? Whereas I think Carson would pitch more to this fabled centred ground in politics. I'm not sure, but and I have to, this is probably going to be quite controversial, and if you're Republican and you're sensible, do feel free to write in and tell me off, but I can't see the Republican Party choosing a black man as their candidate. I'm sorry, but I just can't see that happening. So it looks like it is going to be Trump. Goodness knows why. Maybe all of the Americans know something that I don't. But I just to me, it just seems to be completely celebrity driven, and I just don't understand it, Terence. I don't understand
it. Well, he's an extraordinary figure, Donald Trump, because you know, a catalogue of bankrupt businesses behind him, yet he's regarded as successful in business, and you know, indeed hosted the Apprentice television show in the USA.
It's hilarious. The idea of Alan Sugar standing for Lord Sugar, sorry, standing for Prime Minister over here. It's he'd be more credible, I think, in a way.
Yeah, possibly so. But of course, you know, this isn't even another example of the peculiarity of his popularity, because he's been dropped by NBC. They said no more thanks in terms of The Apprentice after Trump's statements about what he calls immigrants earlier this year. He's been married three times. He's got five children, including a couple with lovely names, Tiffany Trump.
Oh, that's a great name. Sounds like a cartoon character. I really like that.
But even better, his youngest is called Baron William Trump.
He really should be Baron William von Trump, I think. There needs to be a von in there.
But, you know, that similarity to Boris, that same Teflon coating, when Boris got stuck on that zip wire, it only enhanced his positive public image. But had that happened to Mr. Cameron or, say, Harriet Harman, it would have been politically disastrous.
Poor Ed Miliband. Poor old Ed Miliband. And actually, it's exactly the sort of thing that would have happened to poor old Ed Miliband, I think. It would.
And again, the similarity, Boris Johnson married twice. And again, this is an extraordinary thing in this day and age. Boris Johnson has got an unspecified number of children due to extracurricular arrangements that he's been through.
No one seems especially bothered by that.
Well, they don't. I mean, with any other politician, that would be scrutinised under a microscope.
Well, look at Ken Livingstone and some of the attention that he got for similar, less widespread, but similar-ish circumstances.
Absolutely. So just as Boris seems unstoppable in his march to Downing Street 2020, so might be Trump for 2016.
There was a lovely thing that was put on, and I can't remember, I can't find it now, but there was a lovely thing that someone put online that was from one of the American newspapers, I think, that basically said that, yes, Donald Trump had made something like $4.3 billion or was worth this huge amount of money. They said if he had put the money he'd inherited from his father into a sort of basic stocks and shares kind of tracker and done absolutely nothing with it, he'd now be worth $8 billion. So they pointed out that actually Donald Trump hasn't gone out and made his own wealth. If anything, he's gone out and severely damaged wealth he already had, which kind of doesn't hold me with a great deal of confidence for running a country, but what do I know?
And like many of those sort of heritage families in the United States, if one looks into the situations that led to his father, in particular, making all this money,
it doesn't look good in American family politics.
We're talking about the bizarre nature of international cricket after this from Edwin Collins.
Just a day.
your theme song, Jules.
It's such a tune. And the thing that I love about this record, partly because it reminds me of going on, and this is going to depress everybody who listens to this who's older than me, I'm really sorry, but when it came out, I was on holiday in Great Yarmouth with my family, and I can still remember standing on the seafront, and it was blaring out of an amusement arcade whilst I was eating an ice cream, and I must have been about, oh, I don't know, eight, or, I was probably not quite 10, and I was listening to it. And I remember asking my mum and dad what it was, and they didn't know, and I said, oh, but this record is brilliant, and it reminds me of standing there in the sunshine, and what's his face from the Pet Shop Boys, Neil Tennant's Neil Tennant's theory that you'd only have to hear a record. Basically, in order for a record to be successful, you have to make not very much effort to hear it. So basically, the less effort you make to hear a record and you end up hearing it, the more successful that record is. So and the idea that Edwyn Collins, who's always been a kind of an indie sort of cult figure, had an enormous, I mean, that was enormous, that record. It got to 3 or 4 and was absolutely everywhere, even in amusement arcades in Great Yarmouth. I mean, if now you'd said to someone, like, you know, if you said Lawrence from Felt had a massive hit that's come out of an amusement arcade, it was that sort of thing, really. And the other thing I love about it is that my two big interests in music are sort of indie / alternative music and Northern Soul, and that record is both of those things at the same time. It's wonderful. I love it.
It is, you're right. Jules, I have all of the sports channels on my TV, no surprise there.
I was going to say, you're not shocking me thus far.
No, absolutely. All of them, Sky, BT, ESPN at the races. Even British Eurosport, I've got them all. I love football, rugby, horse racing. And what better than to loll on the sofa all day watching a cricket test match?
Lolling in the old sense rather than lolling as in laughing out loud for young persons listening. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Lolling in the very
old. Yes, I really
do.
It sounds ideal.
Sprawled on the sofa.
Excellent.
Watching a test match. Well, currently the England cricket team are halfway through a 3-match series against Pakistan. And the thing is, I can't be bothered to turn the telly on to watch it. This is a home series for Pakistan. It's being hosted in the United Arab Emirates due to the threat of militant, some say terrorist, action back in Pakistan. There just doesn't seem to be any sort of excitement about this series at all. It was thought that because there are a sizable number of Pakistanis working in Dubai, this would add to the attendance figure. But of course, many of them are working and working, you know, very long hours while the match is being played. The Telegraph reported an attendance figure of 54 on the first day of the first test match. So it leads me to ask, Jules, why are they bothering?
That's a really good question, and I'm not entirely sure I've got the answer, to be honest. I saw pictures on TV, and the ground looked sparsely populated. But even 54, that's not even triple figures. I mean, you know, I get more than that for my radio shows sometimes, and I'm not exactly, you know, a world conquering behemoth. So that is. I mean, what do you say? What do you say to the fact that 54 people have turned up to an international test match? In their defence, the organisers have said that, you know, that it's never busy at the start of a test and that more people turn up later on. And it's true. Sometimes some of the tests in over here, particularly the non-Lords tests, so sometimes places like Trent Bridge, and you do look on TV and you see it looks quite thin at first, and then gradually as it goes on, people turn up later in the day. Sometimes at Lords, in fact, it looks sparsely populated for the first bit because everyone's queuing up outside with their picnics. I know, obviously, you're not a fan of picnics. Previous listeners will know this, but everyone queuing up outside with their stuff to get in. So maybe, to be kind, maybe there were thousands of people outside in queues having their bags checked and swearing about it, trying to get in. But it doesn't seem very likely. For what you say about the cultural surroundings and the idea that lots of people are you know, working insanely hard. And yeah, it's that makes me sad in a way, really. The old poem about, do we not have time to stand and stare? Do we not have time to go and watch a cricket test? I mean, really, actually, it's a shame because it's turned out to be rather an interesting and absorbing series, really. But it does make you wonder, doesn't it? Or maybe they've overpitched the venues that they're staying in. There was nothing more depressing in the era when Britpop was starting to fizzle out. So 97, 98, the amount of tours that people like Sleeper, they book them the most ridiculous venues around the country. And then just before the tour was announced, they'd go, oh, there's been a change in venue. And, you know, it was never bigger. It was always smaller. And so yeah. Maybe someone here has gone, oh, yes, all these people, maybe it's been a failure of them. And as my friend would put it, bad admin. Maybe it's been bad admin. I don't know. But
well, I think that's a very good point, because I think one of the issues for sports organisations at the highest level to grapple with is making a game so comfortable to watch on TV at home that nobody but absolute fanatics will spend the now.
And that's a really good point. And that's the thing. And like you say, it's so. I mean, I really want to go and see a cricket. I've never seen a cricket test in England. I really, really want to go on. But you know, short of getting a remortgage on my flat, I'm not really quite sure how I'm meant to finance it.
No, well, that's it. I mean, for Premiership, international football, rugby, or indeed, as you say, international cricket, and it's likely to become a greater problem because we're treated more and more as consumers rather than supporters.
Absolutely.
Now, at the moment, football is running at an all-time high, but cricket faces, I think, a very real problem. Hardly anyone goes to county cricket games, and I can say that with certainty because as a member at Lords, I go to watch Middlesex several times
summer. Yep.
And you know, maybe there's a few hundred other Hardy souls, but some county games would dream of that attendance of 54.
Around these parts, and my nearest cricket club is Sussex, obviously, and they play out at Hove. And again, I've never been, but I hear similar stories. And actually, all of my friends that do go and watch cricket, and actually, tellingly, not just the hardcore cricket enthusiasts, but people the sort of people that like to go to watch things, if you see what I mean. So they're not hugely interested, but they go, oh, well, if that's on, then, you know, we'll go and watch it. It'll be a day out. They all go and watch the Sussex Sharks, which is the 2020 stuff. I know lots of people who are not like us, Terence. They're not as special as us. They won't sit through 5 days of test on TV, but they will.
The fools.
Exactly, but they will. Exactly. The fault is with them.
Charlatans.
Yeah, the fault's with them rather than with us, obviously. But they do. Maybe they should call themselves the Sussex Charlatans. I don't know. But they go and watch. You know, they'll go, oh, we'll go over for the, and again, evening games, floodlit. They go over, I hate to say it again, but they take a picnic and they go and watch it. And maybe in the way cricket is going to have to adapt to market forces. I mean, the short form of the game is the one that makes the money, isn't it? That's the one that the IPL and all that and all that sort of thing. And my dad is a cricket purist. I was brought up with a cricket obsessed father, hence why I am so cricket obsessed, and he always derisively refers to anything that isn't test cricket as pajama cricket because of the uniforms.
I agree with him.
It seems to be moving that way, doesn't it? I don't know if this is a one-off or maybe this is just a sign of movement. I mean, like you say, cricket is undergoing enormous challenges through trying to find a game that people want to go and watch because we live in a more fast-moving world. Maybe people's attention spans can't deal with a five-day test. I don't know.
Well, I think the dilemma for the TV companies is that it makes for very poor television if any sporting contest takes place in front of 54 people.
Well, that's the problem.
In an arena that holds 20,000.
Exactly.
And if the public ever loses interest in Premiership football, then Sky and BT Sport are going to be, you know, empty shells.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I always am. Thoughts on cricket always makes me think. There was I think it was Nike. They did a series of adverts in the 90s that had comments on cricket. And one of them was, you know you're English when you invent a game and everybody else in the world whips you at it, because England weren't doing very well at that point. Also, the same series of adverts had, how can you be playing for 5 days non-stop and it still be a draw at the end of it? And maybe that's why the public needs certainty. They don't need 5 days of people playing in front of 54 people to no end result. I'm not sure. I would be sad if this turned out to be another part of the story, the wider story of the decline of test cricket. But I'm not sure whether it was just a one-off or whether it's just part of a wider, more depressing story about tests.
Do you know, there's a funny thing I do every time I go to a county cricket match is that, you know, as you know, it goes on all day. So that inevitably, from time to time, you might be glancing at your newspaper, a passing bird fluttering across the sky, or, you know, just glance the other way. And, oh, no, there's a catch, the wicket. I immediately look for a replay. And, of course, in county cricket, there are
no cameras.
Oh, you know, I miss
that. Well, that will teach you to be vigilant at all times when you go to county cricket.
Absolutely. Here's an intriguing cover of my favourite Cure song.
Monday's blue, Tuesday's grey, and Wednesday too. Thursday, I don't care about you. It's Friday, I'm in love. Monday, you can fall apart. Tuesday, Wednesday, break my heart. Thursday doesn't even start. It's Friday, I'm in love. Saturday, wait. Sunday always comes too late. Friday never hesitates. I don't care if Monday's black. Tuesday, Wednesday, heart attack. Thursday never looking back. It's Friday, I'm in love.
This year. Not a new concept from Yo La Tengo. It's their 14th album, but the second in which they mix up original tracks and cover versions, and that, of course, was the rather sweet version of The Cure's Friday I'm in Love.
Yeah, I like that. That's nice. I love the original, but that's a decent stab at it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you would like to hear more of this this album with cover versions on it. It's on Spotify, and it's intriguing because Yo La Tengo, they also cover The Loving Spoonful, Hank Williams and Sun Ra.
Wow, that's quite a reach, isn't it?
It's a jamboree bag, yeah. Yes, it is. Jules, amongst your endless array of talents, you're a working musician in a band.
Well, yes, working is... I could not retire off what we've earned, put it that way. But yes, we do occasionally get paid for the privilege of troubling stages.
This week, the owner of the 100 Club in London said music venues in the UK are at crisis point, with small venues closing due to a range of issues from noise complaints, licensing problems, and I suggest a lack of interest from the public. Now, I'm not expecting you to agree with me.
I was going to say, I'm already clenching, but I'm sure it's going to be fine.
Briefly, and probably unexpectedly, let me draw a parallel with the mine workers in the 1980s and the closure of steelworks today to the music venues that we're just referring to. No parent today would say, I really want my child to go down a dangerous pit in the earth, in the dark all day, digging for coal. But that's what Mr. Scargill and his colleagues argued for in the 1980s. But people are trained for other careers now, and that'll be the case in the steel industry. And I think instead of putting the focus on the job losses, we should be putting every effort into retraining the people for careers more suitable to 21st century Britain. Now, music venues, maybe fewer people in a similar way, maybe fewer people wish to be entertained this way. It's 2015 and young people want to experience music through YouTube, especially Spotify, sorry, I like Spotify
as a concept.
Spotify.
Maybe that could be a hip hop version, an airborne version of Spotify, perhaps.
Yes, Spotify with wings. And possibly, you know, X Factor finalists in the comparative luxury of Hammersmith Apollo or Wembley Arena. It's just life moving on, Jules.
I do and don't agree with this. There are some bits that I do agree with. I do agree that life does move on. I'm not really very happy about it, but it does. I think that the arguments for the coal miners, yeah, certainly who would want to do that job, I agree with that. But I think you can make another comparison with coal miners and steel workers and you know, small gig venues, which is just the bigger picture, really. And the idea of, you know, if we don't have these things, industries, what do we replace them with? And for me, the first thing that came into my head when I knew we were going to talk about this, the first thing that I thought of in terms of small gig venues being sort of got rid of is that they're very much part of a process, and they're very much part of the toilet. Well, you know, we all remember the toilet circuit, don't we? And actually, being an indie obsessive, I could, for a while, I could navigate you around Britain depending upon what the small venue was in that town, because I had all the posters up on my wall and they always had tour dates on them. So me and my friend this occasion in the pub, one of us will say Leeds and the other one will go Cockpit, and one will say Hully and Hull, and the other one will say Welly, Southampton, Joyce, all of those things. And the one headline points that keeps cropping up in my head, and this is where I'm going to say something enormously controversial to certain sections of society, I really like Coldplay. I think they're really good. And they are rumoured to be headlining Glastonbury next year, and it will be the third time that they have headlined Glastonbury since, and they only started going in 2000 2001, so within sort of less than 15 years the same band has headlined a major music festival three times. And in ye olden days, it was completely unheard of. I remember talking to a friend of mine in the sort of the late 90s who was an obsessive Glastonbury attender. She used to, in true Glastonbury style, run juggling workshops there, and only at Glastonbury would you do that. And and she, I remember saying to her, oh, do you think whoever it was will play again, Blur or someone like that? And she went, oh, no, he never has the same headliner again. That never happens. And to me, it kind of suggests a paucity of really top level bands in order. I mean, when you look at headliners now, I mean, even bands that I really, really like Foals headlining festivals, you'd think, well, they're not a headline band. Surely they don't have that reach, you know, in the public. And I do worry that the reason why we might not have these enormo bands anymore is because there isn't a small circuit on which people can cut their teeth. And the other point that I want to make in this regard is that as well as that, you've, when you say, oh, you know, it doesn't, you know, dying industries, doesn't make money anymore, blah, 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 blah. The live circuit is enormous. The touring is the only way that bands make money. But of course, I suppose now you say bands go into sort of top level venues, like your X Factor kiddies. They immediately go and play huge venues, don't they? You would never see Leona Lewis at the club Eiffelbach in Cardiff, would you? But then equally, these X Factor people, they come and they go, don't they? They don't have that level of that, you know, they haven't got that level of stagecraft. You know, they haven't. There's a lovely song on the first Muse album. Again, Muse are a really enormous band now, but on their first album, there is a song, I can't remember, it might be Muscle Museum, and at one point Matt Bellamy sings in angsty style, I've played every toilet. And when he was asked about it afterwards, he did say, oh, we've played everywhere that smells in Britain, we've played it at some point. And Muse are now enormous, and maybe that's why we don't have these sort of these all-conquering bands. I mean, I would, and the other thing is I would hate for it to go. I mean, I totally agree that you have to move on to the future, and I think that any political party that wants to win the next general election has to understand an emphasis, has to get technology and get the internet and understand that stuff. And this is where the next level of jobs are coming from. But there's a sort of a cultural thing in a way that I sort of worry that we lose, really. The idea that, you know, that people don't spend time together in venues anymore makes me very sad. So I mean I do get your point that life moves on. Again, this is something else that we often disagree about on this programme. I think it's another sign of the hollowing out of London, particularly, and the 100 Club and the 12 Bar Club and that sort of thing. It's a hollowing out of London, because all of these places are just replaced with luxury flats that are bought by overseas investors. That is the pattern that happens. It's all sold as redevelopment, and actually that's all it is. And I hate the idea that you've got a once vibrant culture. And I don't agree with you. I think that people do want to go and see gigs, and I think that if it's there, it would still happen. But increasingly these places are being sort of ripped up and got rid of. And that makes me sad that we're, as a nation, we're sort of moving towards something different that I don't think gives us any, doesn't make us any rich. It might make us richer financially, but it doesn't make us richer in any other way, I don't think.
The experience, though, can still be, even if people want to go, I still from time to time get invited to gigs in London, kind of pub type environments. And it's often a regrettable experience, you know, with little having changed from those, you know, the kind of pub rock days of my era of the early 70s, you know, when your feet would stick to the ground. And I really do mean you'd have to
tear yourself up,
your feet, your feet up from the beer stained carpet. You know, absurdly high admission prices, standing room only in a room entirely unsuitable for listening to music. You know, these pub or small venues, often the acoustics are terrible in an era where we expect more. And
well, maybe you're onto something there. Maybe these places haven't modernised, and maybe that's why. I mean, there are some venues that still do very well. One of my local venues is the Tunbridge Wells Forum, and that's still. As one of the very few that's managing to kind of on that circuit, that's managing to keep up. There's quite a burgeoning live circuit in Hastings, actually, where my band often plays, again, in pubs. And that seems to work, but then we don't charge admission. So I'm not sure. I'm funny enough, we can pick this up next week, because I'm playing a gig tomorrow night down in Hastings at a venue that was derelict until fairly recently, is now being used again as an art space called the Observer Building. And we're on the bill to support a lady called the Space Lady that's come over from the States. And that is, people are being charged admission to that. And they have to pay, I think it's £7 a ticket. This sounds awfully like a plug. I don't mean it that way, but I'm just sort of thinking that it's £7 a ticket, and they're sold from a local record shop which is run by one of the support bands. So it's real kind of cottage industry stuff. But I'll be interested to see how many tickets are sold. It's not in the main hall of this venue, it's in a back room. Right. So I will report back next week as to what the acoustics were like and whether many people came. Because it'd be interesting to see in this day and age, people confirm on Facebook that they're coming. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether people do turn up and whether there is still an appetite for that sort of thing.
I know, you know, it's similar to what we were talking about with sports as well, in that it's regrettable that these days as well, hopefully with your venue accepted, those attending are treated as consumers. You know, another example would be, you know, a hugely inflated prices for drinks. You know, or a glass of red wine and, I don't know, a Diet Coke, please. Oh, £9.75.
I've bought rounds before at venues where you know, you hand a £10 note over, expecting change, and it turns out it's not enough. So yeah, I do. I remember going to see PJ Harvey at the Brighton Dome years ago, gosh, 2004, I think, with two friends of mine, and two of us had a pint of lager, but it was sort of gig sized pints of lager, so somewhere between a half and a pint, you know, they were those stubby little glasses, and two of us had little beers and the other one had a vodka and orange, I think, and we did that three times and I'd used up £30.
It was
about £9 something around, if I remember correctly. I'd gone out with £30 and I had something like £1.80 when I left the venue. So it was ridiculous, really. So I do agree that venues need to get sort of wise to that sort of thing. But equally, you know, I can't see it as a good thing, and I can't see it as a natural thing of all these venues closing, mostly because all you get in, particularly in London, all you get in the places is redevelopment stuff. And maybe the one thing is begatting something else, and that maybe people watch stuff on YouTube and find the music in other ways because there are less and less of these sort of venues around. I wonder if it's that way around.
My concluding point to put to you is that I may not be the target generation, of course.
I might not be either, to be brutally honest.
the young people I know in their teens, early 20s, would never dream of going out to see unknown bands. And I think maybe something to do at the heart of this. Young people today have got nothing to rebel against. Their parents are their friends. They sit down and watch the Great British Bake Off together. And I wonder if that's got something to do with it. And that is why it's possible that small music venues are the coal mines of the late 2010s.
I don't know. Then having said that, where I live, there are still lots of young bands coming up through Hastings. But of course, ultimately, there are huge amounts of frustration. The thing that I hear the most, and I write for a local publication, music publication in Hastings, so quite often I meet people at things or interview people. And the one thing that everybody says is, do you know what Hastings needs? A venue. There is no small, there are pubs in Hastings which you can play in, and there's this new venue that I'm playing at, but there's no Tunbridge Wells Forum sized venue in Hastings. There used to be a nightclub called The Crypt where bands used to play downstairs, and again, that wasn't the best place to see bands, but lots of people played down there. And Kasabian played on their first ever tour supporting somebody when they were nothing, and I turned a ticket down, as I always do for these things. But I'm sort of Forrest Gump in reverse. I'm always away from famous moments of musical history. I could give you a long list of I turned down a ticket for The Strokes' first ever UK show at Brighton Pavilion. You know, I've done all sorts of ridiculous things, but there's a frustration now in Hastings that, you know, young people do still want to form bands. That seems to be our experience. There are several sort of up and coming young bands in Hastings, but they're getting increasingly frustrated because there aren't the venues to house them. So who could blame them if they packed it in?
But if they wanted to be seen these days, those people in the young bands, I'm not saying this is particularly a good thing at all.
They put a video on YouTube
or audition for Britain's Got Talent or something of that nature, rather than slogging round 2 or 3 years playing 75 capacity venues.
To go back to my point earlier, that's what gives you longevity. If you join Britain's Got Talent or X Factor and play, you'll get a tour of big venues, but that's probably the only tour you'll ever really get. And then you'll be like Steve Brookstein, previous winner of Pop Factor or X Factor, whatever it was then, who now plies his trade in wine bars. So actually, you know, if you do want longevity, maybe your Matt Bellamy's playing in every toilet is what you want and what you need. And actually, in a way, I do wonder if it's short-sighted of the music industry, because we've talked about touring and how much money bands can make the industry from touring. And maybe the industry is sort of killing itself, allowing itself to be killed off by developers and whatnot, because they're not breeding these big bands capable of doing these huge tours anymore. Maybe in 10 or 15 years' time, that's when all of a sudden we're going to have a Glastonbury situation again, when, who on earth do we get to headline? I don't know. Also, can I just... The one final point I want to make about noise complaints, it absolutely, really, really gets my goat when people move next door to a venue that they know does live music. This happens in Hastings Old Town. One of the streets in Hastings Old Town has loads of venues on it. And one of my many polymath kind of features is that I DJ out with a friend of mine. And we agreed to play a venue a few weeks ago that's a little sort of place in this high street. And the high street is full of bars and restaurants and shops, and is a very thriving part of Hastings Old Town, which has become very famous with the London set. Everyone's buying houses down here and coming down for the weekend and all that kind of thing. And they said, we've had a noise complaint. And I said, what's that? And they went, someone in one of the flats above. And all of these places have flats above them, and some of the shops do. And I said, oh, have they been there? They've been there long. And they went, oh, no, they only moved in a few weeks ago. And I feel like saying that this is not new. This is not a new thing that there are venues here. When you came to look at the flat, because I assume that you did come to look at the flat before you decided to live there, you would have seen all these places. And if you had anything about you, you would have thought, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not always very good at forward planning, but even I would see a restaurant that does music at night and think, oh, do you know what? That might be a bit noisy at night. Maybe I don't want to do that. If I've got a busy job, maybe I don't want to be disturbed every evening. I mean, people then move in and then complain, and they go to, it absolutely winds me up. I just think it's the most ridiculous thing. And it just feels like sometimes venues must behave themselves, and they must, you know, they must play within their limits. But for people to move into an area and then complain, I do feel like we're kowtowing to people with money sometimes, I must admit. And again, that makes me rather cross.
You can contact us, and we'd like to hear from you. You can just send us a quick message on Twitter, SuperJules84.
I am, funnily enough, wearing a Superman T-shirt as we speak, so that is very apt, isn't it?
Well, that's very apt. And I am Sir Terence on Twitter.
Much more distinguished, yes.
Jules, you're on Barricade Radio next Wednesday. People can listen to your two-hour show.
They can, yes. On it's Indie Wonderland is the name of the one I do on Wednesday nights, and it's usually on from 8 till 10 on Barricade Radio. Barricaderadio.com is how you get to it. The Barricade Radio had tweets as well, so if there's ever any changes, then they tweet as Barricade Radio, so that's how you can find out about it. And I'm no Saturday Social this week, so I'll tell you about that next week.
Many thanks to Rona for her help this week. What are we playing out with, Jules?
Well, that is a good question, and I'm glad you asked me that. Now I've opened the page, I can tell you what we're playing out with. On my Indie Wonderland show this week, I did a sort of a special show, which I will put up on Mixcloud, where I decided madly whilst driving home at night that what I really needed to do to reduce my planning and to reduce my commitments was to plan a two-hour show based entirely around the radio alphabet from Alpha to Zulu. And I had an enormous amount of fun planning it and doing the show. It was great. And my C for Charlie brought me to this, and I think this record is so evocative. Actually, interestingly for me, it's evocative of a childhood and a youth that I didn't have, but I can sort of imagine I have, really. I can't lie and say that I was old enough to go to raves, because I really, really wasn't. But hearing this, I almost feel like there is, you know, a whiff of burgers and an amyl nitrate in the air, and someone is wandering past me in a black bomber jacket. You know, I can almost see, and I'm standing in a muddy field. I can almost sense myself here. And this is a really early Prodigy track from when they were first really kind of starting out at raves. Because they, again, a band that could probably headline a festival, but who started off playing in muddy fields on the rave scene. And I love this. This is also samples the Public Information film from the 1970s as well. This is the Prodigy, and this is Charlie.
We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Charlie says, always tell your mummy before you go off somewhere.
You have been listening to a Dacom Media production.
Charlie and I were out the back when Vera and Dave came by and said, come along for a picnic. And I was going, but Charlie said, he says I better tell Mum where I'm going. So we told him to wait while we went and asked. But Mum was talking to the milkman. And she talked such a long time that when I had asked her and she'd said yes, the others had gone. Mum asked us why we hadn't gone, and when I told her, she said we'd been good for not going and would we like a day out with her instead? Charlie says, always tell your mummy before you go off somewhere so she knows who you are with.